Hello and welcome to Gay for Horror, the show where not all the movies are gay, but I sure am. How are you doing? So I have today to talk about the end of 2020 and all of the horror movies therein. I think this was overall such an extraordinary year for horror movies, even though we didn't get Candyman and we didn't get A Quiet Place 2. And we didn't get a bunch of other movies that were supposed to come out. We did get a really extraordinary crop of films to talk about, and it was very difficult. I've picked 10, but I think I could have easily done 20 or more. So yeah, I'm gonna go through these almost alphabetically. I'm not going to go through them al actually alphabetically because of a few reasons. One is that I'm going to keep these mostly non-spoiler, but I do actually want to spoil or discuss at length in a fashion that will spoil a couple of them. So I'm going to save those for the end if anyone wants to jump off and not listen to that. However, just to reiterate from last year, I have sort of feelings about top 10 lists. One is that I think that they are lovely as a device to proliferate film appreciation, and I often find titles of films on top 10 lists that I didn't know about or that I hadn't thought to watch, and I think that they're very good for that reason. I don't particularly care to like fight with strangers on the internet about which film is worthy of top 10 or not. And I also don't number them because I have just no idea what criteria one would use to distinguish between number 10 and number 9. Like at that point, I think you're just making it up, which is fine, but I don't really care to put that much energy into the number system. So it's just going to be 10 that I liked a lot, but do keep in mind that there's also like another 10 I could pick that also would be very satisfying to talk about this year. Yeah, I think that is all I need to say going in. Again, mostly alphabetically, I'm going to break a couple of instances toward the end, but you'll figure that out. The first one I have is Carmilla, which I did do a whole review of. It was actually I think the last film I did a full review of. It was very inspiring to me. It was not a film that I knew existed. And so it was really it just arrived in my inbox. I had a request actually to participate in a Q&A from Cinema Detroit, which is the local independent theater here in Detroit, Michigan, that I love very much, which has been closed for too long in the year of 2020. But I was invited to do a Q&A, and we ended up doing a Q&A with the director and cinematographer, Emily Harris and Michael Wood, respectively. And that was extraordinarily fun. You can find it on YouTube, I think, still. But this movie really just came. This movie is like the movie. It's my taste incarnate in a way. If you haven't figured out, I do like very beautiful cinematography. I do like very classy as fuck sort of period, gothic type things. My favorite horror movie is The Innocents, directed by Jack Clayton, which is a very classy old-timey haunted house movie based on The Turn of the Screw with a screenplay co-written by Truman Capote. So, things in that vein really speak to my person. And this one is incredibly classy, period, lesbian romance based on a very classic novel, which involves vampires. And it's one of the most beautifully shot movies I've seen all year. Michael Wood, the cinematographer, who's extraordinary, in the process of the Q&A that we did, discussed that he used no more than two professional film lights in any one shot of the movie. So most of the movie is lit by candlelight or by natural light. And it sort of looks like a really elegant painting come to life. It's so beautiful, and it's so carefully lit. And there were so many cases where they would shoot based upon natural light and fight with the natural light and catch catch the sun at the right angle, hitting a church on a hilltop. And they would fight with all of those things to make it happen in the camera and to make the movie as organic as possible. And I think that that plays out stylistically, and you really feel the atmosphere that they create, the sort of high contrast lighting atmosphere where there's lots of shadows and lots of lighting that is very natural looking, where there's characters who are in the dark, but with strokes of light coming from a candle or a window. And that kind of duality speaks to the underlying themes of the movie about, this young woman who is being abused essentially in the name of religion, who falls in love with a guest to the estate, who is happens to be a young woman who might be a vampire. And she kind of is fighting between all of these forces that are pulling her in one way or the other, and also kind of redefining for herself what she feels is is the correct way to be. And it's a very queer love story. It's a very beautiful gothic romance, and it is a really effectively atmospheric and spooky classic horror movie. So if you haven't seen Carmilla, directed by Emily Harris, you must. It's brilliant. So I just realized I don't know how to do alphabetical order because I'm looking at my list and I put the movies in, not in alphabetical order, but I thought that I had. That's really embarrassing. The movie I have next starts with L. That's not true. That's not alphabetical order. The next movie in alphabetical order would be His House. His House is a movie I talked about, I think, in the most recent episode that I recorded, which was what I watched in October. His House is a Netflix original, directed by Remy Weeks, and it is, I believe, a debut film, and it's really extraordinary. It is probably probably the scariest movie in terms of, like, I don't know what criteria you use for that, but the most affecting in terms of constructing and executing scare moments, and also the most memorable for me of any film this year, probably. It's really exceptionally good at setting up and achieving a very atmospheric and alarming visual moment, and particularly with this kind of, like, unfounded use of what seems like point of view, which I think is something that I often think about in terms of The Shining. One of the things in The Shining that people talk a lot about is the idea that the camera is almost anthropomorphic, that it has almost a mind of its own. And there's these moments in The Shining where, like, the camera is sort of trailing behind Danny on the little, like, tiny tyke bike, whatever you call that. And then Danny will, like, turn the corner, and the camera will not turn with him, and the camera will just sort of stay behind and linger, almost like it suddenly has a resistance to follow, whereas the imperative of the camera is typically to follow the actor or follow the action. And so that there's this quality where we sort of start to wonder, like, from whose perspective are we seeing the characters? And I think that that sort of effectively works in His House as well, where there's some shots that there are some shots that seem like they're just there'll be a cut to a shot that seems like a non-particular point of view shot, but then it sort of reveals itself to have personality and to have personhood in a way that I find really alarming. It's also a really a beautiful movie emotionally. It's a so so this is a, it's a movie about immigrants to the UK who are put into this public housing, while the sort of UK government weighs their claim to asylum or their request for asylum. And it's this public housing option that has probably been passed through by many people in similar situations. And so it really builds the legacy of the personal, emotional, and political stakes of these characters who are living in this public housing option while they're waiting for their fates to be determined by a government. It weighs those stakes against the supernatural, And also against the things that they're running from, the things that happened to them that led to their attempt to seek asylum. So there are kind of very much in the spirit of a classic ghost story, there are very literal and also very thematic or emotionally driven kind of specters in the walls. They're literally specters in the walls, and they're also imagined or emotional specters in the character's mind. So it's probably one of the most exquisite ghost stories of the year. And there's another on this list that's also really, really good, and I think they're very comparable to each other or worth speaking in similar breath. So let me just mention, let me break order again and talk about the other one that I think falls into this similar vein, which is really probably again one of my sort of top ideal versions for or approaches to a horror movie, which is Jairo Bustamante's La Llorona, which is I think much like his house, a really exquisite movie that uses the ghost story as a vehicle. I think what, so I read an interview with Jairo Bustamante where he was talking about his making a horror movie with La Llorona, which by the way distinctly is not the Linda Cardellini movie from a year ago called Curse of La Llorona. It's a very different movie if you're on IMDb and you're confused. But he really wanted to make a movie about political genocide. He recognized that it was a topic that he felt no one would want to necessarily engage with. And so he sought to try and find a delivery mechanism that would make it able to be addressed, or would allow him to address what he wanted to address. And so he looked at what was popular, and he recognized that the two most popular genres were horror movies and superhero movies. And he thought, of the two, horror movie would work better. So this is a movie about a general who has participated in a politically motivated genocide, who has lived a long life and is now being tried for war crimes, who seemingly is going to escape conviction for those war crimes, but who, in the context of his home with his family hiding out from protesters outside, is experiencing some supernatural manifestations of the legacy of the violence that he participated in, particularly through the character of this house cleaner who comes to the house, who is fairly mysterious and sort of shows up one day, and who starts to spark some sort of supernatural happenings. And we sort of slowly find out the, much like with his house, we find out the kind of emotional stakes behind the supernatural happenings. And it builds to a really a climax that reminded me of one of my favorite horror movies, which is Carnival of Souls, which is a really classic 60s low budget horror movie, which I believe is in the public domain, so you can probably find it on like YouTube. But the idea of the ghosts kind of confronting the general. In Carnival of Souls, there's this sort of like, it ends with this sort of dance macabre of all of these ghosts dancing together in this strange way. But in La Llorona, this sort of similar thing happens, but it's more of a direct confrontation. And actually the endings, I guess, without spoiling what's in the ending so much as other than that there are ghosts in them, which I think is not really a spoiler because of, well, they're ghost movies. But the endings of His House and La Llorona are sort of lovely bookends in a strange way, because they both involve some amount of confronting the supernatural, the sort of the sorry, the emotional past, the sort of emotional, social, political past that fuels the supernatural happenings. But it's different because, of course, in His House, we're dealing with people who are refugees, and in La Llorona, we're dealing with someone who's a war criminal. So the kind of the history and the relationship to past trauma is different in the sense that, of course, the refugees are very much people who have been affected traumatically, and the general in this case is someone who has done actively trauma to other people. So His House on La Llorona are easily among the two best horror movies of the year, and they're both, I think, really exceptional examples of ghost stories, which are in really well able to convey a social political meaning in addition to being scary and good and atmospheric and effective as horror movies at the sort of most essential level. Okay, I'm just not going in alphabetical order anymore. I'm giving up because I want to talk about what I want to talk about, the order I want to talk about it in. The next thing I want to talk about is The Invisible Man, which I did a full episode on, so you can hear my really extended long thoughts, fresh having seen it in theaters. Invisible Man was one of the last movies that I saw in theaters. It wasn't quite the last one. The last movie I saw in theaters this year was The Lodge, which was not my favorite. But let's not talk about that. Let's talk about The Invisible Man, which was one of my favorites. This was one where I was really blown away and surprised. I think a lot of these other ones I went in very optimistic and was very pleased and satisfied. But this was a big surprise for me because I thought it would probably be good. But I didn't think it was going to be quite as extraordinary as it is. I think what I talked about a lot in the episode on the Invisible Man was just like the care and attention to detail in the shot by shot breakdown. Like, this is a very classically kind of storyboarded, planned out, meticulously arranged suspense movie that I think, much like very classic suspense movies, like classic Hitchcock films, for example, you could just really take each shot and break it down very carefully as to what's happening in terms of the effect on the audience. I think one of the things Hitchcock was best at is, because he's kind of a character and he probably lied a lot, and I'm a huge fan, so I'm just saying this as someone who's read a lot of his interviews. He was sort of always performing, I think, in a way that makes it a little bit difficult to decipher some of some of his kind of like innermost thoughts. But he did have, and I think was especially publicly able to articulate, this way that he saw the sort of, the shooting and the assemblage, the filming and the assemblage, the cutting or editing of the film as having an effect on the audience. And that was kind of the particularly meticulous way that he went about making films, is why his films were really effective as suspense films, is because there was really a careful thought about what the audience would feel, or what they were seeing and how the shots were relating to each other and how the audience would feel about that connection of things. And I think The Invisible Man is really extraordinary at emulating that same sort of specificity. And that's a stylistic thing that some people really don't like. Some people find it really oppressive and like depressing to watch something so meticulously staged. But I love it. There's like these little things in that movie where it's like, the shot of where you sort of like hear the dog bowl before you see the dog bowl, I think is what it is. There's like a dog bowl that slides into frame and it makes a thud, and you hear it before you see it. So you don't know what it is. You don't know if you're being caught. I mean, it's incredibly good at putting you in the mindset of the character, where we're with Elizabeth Moss and we're so worried that we're going to get caught, and we hear a noise and we freak out that we're going to get caught, and then we see it's just the dog bowl, and then we have relief. And it's really putting you in her perspective so vividly. And I just think every movie should do that. I think every movie should do that. I think every movie should be that careful. I think every movie should have that incredible, not every movie, I'm lying. But I really like that, especially in suspense films. I think the more you can connect the audience to the point of view of the main character, the more intense the experience is. And I find The Invisible Man to be a very tense experience. I love the sort of, it's also quite John Carpenter. Like, the thing about Halloween was it was so good at like the delivery on the promise of Michael Myers, and then the kind of like surprise withholding of Michael Myers, to the point where you as an audience member are kind of always looking in the windows because he might be there. but sometimes he's not. And so sometimes Halloween would create a moment where you would expect Michael Myers to be, and he wasn't there, and sometimes you wouldn't expect, and he was. So it kind of had this gameplay quality that some people have described about it. And I think The Invisible Man has that thing where it's like there's these great, really wide shots of like empty space, and you have this conjecture about whether the Invisible Man is there or not. Or you sort of see things in the frame that lead you to believe that maybe someone is there, and you become sort of very aligned with the protagonist in terms of seeing and suspecting that something is going on. And also, I think too, this is a really great modern version of this story. It sort of doesn't fuck around about the fact that it's not a movie where the protagonist is, where the movie sort of like takes and treats the protagonist as irrational. The movie sort of always is on the side of, yes, this man is abusive. Yes, this man is dangerous. Yes, he's tormenting her. And people in the movie don't believe her, but the experience of the movie is that we are with her and we know what is happening. And we are also being made to feel irrational. So I think it's a really important kind of reversal of some of the tropes of these kinds of like classic gothic, like My Husband Is Trying to Kill Me movies, which are very much about the woman being hysterical and irrational. She's never hysterical or irrational. The world around her is sort of ill-inclined to recognize what is happening to her. And that's really the root of her problem. And I think that that is a really important and strong reversal of some of the tropes in earlier, like 1940s classic gothic films, where the wife was hysterical. And then particularly in the Hitchcock ones, we'll say, because in Rebecca and Suspicion, there's this very notable reversal where not only is the woman treated as hysterical, but then at the end it turns out like the husband wasn't a murderer, even though he was either scripted to be or was in the novel. But we had to take it out because it was considered too dark or too sinister for classical Hollywood to have Olivier or Cary Grant be a murderer. You couldn't really avow that that was a real possibility or that her paranoia was real. And now we can. And I think that that's an important switch. And I think it's an important switch in this movie. And I think it is, the ending of the movie is incredibly satisfying and cathartic. And I think I just think it's one of the most brilliant things. I was so surprised by this and I was so happy by it. So if you haven't seen The Invisible Man, and if you didn't get to see it in a theater, I sympathize because it's like the gamifyingness of like seeing things in the frame or catching something. There's a lot of wide shots where something could be in the frame and you're always looking for the thing in the frame, and I think that does work better on a big screen because you kind of have to take it all in. But alas, it's not available in theaters anymore and probably won't be for a very long time. So if you haven't seen it, please watch it at home, and I don't know. Do your best. One of the things I wish would happen, by the way, in the hypothetical future where the world exists, I would really like to sit through like a repertory program of all of the best movies of 2020 that didn't get to play in theaters, because Invisible Man did play in theaters, but most of these I did not get to see in theaters, which is very rare for me. So. And I would love to see Carmilla in theaters. I would love to see his house in theaters. Oh my goodness, it would be amazing. So maybe in an maybe in maybe another day. Okay. I don't want to talk about that one yet. Okay. So let's talk about The Vast of Night. It's not alphabetical anymore. Fuck it. Let's talk about The Vast of Night. I rewatched this recently. Talk about a movie like The Invisible Man that's very meticulously choreographed and staged and shot. The Vast of Night is exquisite. Have people seen this movie? I don't even know. It's on Amazon Prime. That's kind of where it debuted. It was exclusively streaming. This is a sci-fi movie. It is, I guess, by some accounts, not a horror movie. I don't know. I think I have a very expansive understanding of what horror is. So to me, it's a horror movie because it's suspenseful and includes things that are scary. But it is more of a sci-fi horror movie, and it's so good. Much like The Invisible Man, this is one that definitely seems very conscious and aware of its references. So it is a sort of small town in the 1950s, and there are these two young teenagers who work at the radio station, and they are kind of the only people in town who aren't at this big basketball game. And the entire town is at this big basketball game, and while the entire town is at this big basketball game, these two kids are like uncovering an alien conspiracy on the radio. And it plays with such a sort of vivid homage to things like Twilight Zone. It literally opens with a TV set and then pushes in through the TV set. And then at various times, the film kind of reverts to looking at the characters through this old like cathode ray TV set. The sort of big ones before digital. It's so wonderfully kind of nodding to its period, and also particularly to film of its period and TV of its period. But it's so also so modern and good. One of the things I love about it, and I want to point out about it, is there's something really sort of especially queer about it, because I think it's very much about, there aren't necessarily queer characters by name or by self-identity, but there is. It's kind of about like what happens. What you see when you are looking at the world in a way that other people aren't. And this kind of like these kids are like the forgotten kids who, everyone else is doing something somewhere else, right? Everyone else is occupied with, I mean, literally a basketball game. And if that's not a metaphor for heterosexuality, what is? But everyone else is really preoccupied with this basketball game. And these two kids are like the kind of forgotten ones who are just hanging around the radio station doing this other shit that's like odd. And they both have these big dreams, and they're unusual, and they are uncomfortable, and they want to get out of their town. And then there's these sort of supporting characters who have really also, I think, notably kind of against the norm identities. Sort of, they get this phone call from a black man on the radio who self-describes that way in a time where he would probably not even be welcome in the town. And then also they meet a woman who had a child at a very young age outside of marriage, and so she also would have been, I think, notably kind of maligned for that fact in that time period. So it sort of gathers together these people who are kind of the others or the outsiders in a very normative society, and it sort of tells us their part of the story, and they have this alignment with things that are sort of otherworldly. And I think it really develops that idea of this kind of like really quiet otherness, but like in this sort of very charmed radio play way. I mean, there are scenes where it's like fully black screen with just audio. Like that, it's really like a live radio play that's come to life. But it's also very visual, because there are these really carefully staged and executed tracking shots, like long tracking shots. And it's a mix of very cinematic and very radio and very still. And yet also, I think stylistically, it's like totally visually incredible as well. So I can't recommend that enough. I think it's a really special, sort of strange movie that has a feeling that I love, which is like, it just feels like a long kind of magical, weird night, which I think is a very attractive quality in a movie. So I really recommend The Vast of Night if you have not seen it. This next one was also a total surprise. It's something that I watched on a whim, because I've been watching just every movie. I've been watching every movie, because why not? Given what else, what I'm not doing anything else. So, but I just watched it just because it existed, and I didn't know what it was, and I was really taken by it. So, this is a movie called Spontaneous. This one, I think, too, is, I think, I guess, by some accounts, debatable as to whether it's a horror movie. But again, I have a pretty expansive sense of what's horror, and I think this one is really charming to me, because it's just like truly, if someone to like pick your favorite teen rom-com, minus 10 Things I Hate About You, but like it's just like it 10 Things I Hate About You, but like people are exploding. And I think that is just in and of itself so priceless. I did take screenwriting in college, and I probably wasn't very good at it, But like this, one of the things I would say is like all of the things that I wrote were considered unusual, I guess. And I remember one time anecdotally, someone told me that they were speaking to a professor, and her exact quote was, "He really marches to the beat of his own drum, doesn't he?" And I think, like, I had written some really cuckoo script. Anyway, the point being, I very rarely like see a movie. Like, I love all of these movies, and especially the things that I love. A lot of the things that I love are things that I would never in a million years like pitch to anyone. And granted, I'm not a writer, and I'm whatever. I was never a writer. I took like two screenwriting classes, but this is just one of these movies where it's like, I absolutely, if you gave me enough time and enough audacity, I could have ended up with something in the vicinity of this, probably nowhere near as good. But like, this is very much the kind of energy that I had as a really bad novice screenwriter, which was like, I want to take something totally adorable and wholesome, and like I want to do like a family comedy, but like there's murders, but like I want to take something very sweet and simple and nostalgic, and then I want to throw in something catastrophic. And that was very much my vibe, and people found it jarring and confusing, and I had a professor tell me that like no one thinks murder is funny. And maybe not, maybe she's right, I don't know, but I just feel like this is just like so weird. This is very much my energy in a way that not like Carmilla or His House or La Llorona, which are very much the energy of like what I admire and I'm attracted to as a viewer. This is like very much like I totally wrote stuff that was as cuckoo bananas as this, and I just admire it. Like, I just love it. I love how sweet. I love that it's not like I'm so bored by really like mean, jaded high school characters. I just feel like no one's even like that. I don't think anyone was ever like that. I think people who are mean in high school are super insecure and uncomfortable and whatever. There's just some, I love that it's not a mean comedy or dark, I like that it's not. It's just like the, it's such a nice, it's like the best romantic comedy of the year. And also, there is a constant threat of spontaneous combustion. I don't know how else to explain that besides, just imagine the most genuine, wholesome rom-com of the year, and then add into it, people are spontaneously combusting at a rate that is alarming. And that mortality becomes a very vivid part of the fabric of your kind of like adolescent rom-com experience, which, by the way, I think is really effective. I mean, I mentioned this when I talked about it in the last episode. I think that probably, mass shootings were kind of on the mind as to like what is this sort of supernatural thing standing in for, because the truth is that there is a really unfortunate awareness and heightened sensitivity toward the possibility of this like mass death phenomenon in high schools in the US, in the contemporary world. And that sucks. But watching this in the middle of a pandemic was like, oh, this is incredibly vividly about the experience of mortality. And also the really kind of difficult experience of coping with mortality in a way where, you're having to see the rate of death in the world, or in your community, and you're having to figure out a way to exist with that information, like to persist with that information in mind, like how to wake up and go to work when you sort of can read statistics on death on a daily basis. And it really unexpectedly was really a kind of quintessential movie for me of the pandemic, because it was like, this is the world that I'm living in, where I have to go teach a class, and also every day I'm getting an update on how many people have died. And it's really hard. It's hard to sort of exist in a fun rom-com space with this information looming over my head. And it's hard to have small interests or endeavor. You know, it's hard to sort of take the interest in like these small parts of life, because we'll look at what's happening around us, right? And I think that this movie really juggles that so beautifully. And there are scenes, I mean, you know, as to whether it's a horror movie, I don't know, but I like to include things that are macabre that I think fit in the spirit of horror. And I think this is one of those things because ultimately there are scenes in here that I think are some of the most effective horror scenes I've seen all year, where there's just this kind of vivid, terrifying, totally randomized death. Like the totally randomized death is scary. You know, one of the movies when we would talk about the scariest movies ever, I mean, a lot of the things that genuinely, one of the movies that most unnerved me genuinely was the first time I saw Zodiac, which I just think is a brilliant movie. I rewatched it this year too. But there, you know, one of the scariest scenes on film for me is the scene at Lake Berryessa in Zodiac, because it's just like a nice day that's beautiful and sunny, and this couple is just sitting out by the lake, and then this guy just walks up and stabs them. And the sort of like painful randomization of that like is so over like it's overwhelmingly terrifying to me. And I think that that's the sort of theme in this movie too, is it's like it's just randomized, and there's not there's truly sort of nowhere one could run or escape to. It's just like children are exploding, and also we have to finish high school. And that phenomenon is like a really it's a great high school movie. It's a great rom-com. It's a terrifying movie in a lot of ways. And the fact that it's all of those things at once, it makes me so happy. I think this is such a brilliant, inspired movie. So if you haven't seen Spontaneous, you can rent it and stuff. It's on, it never played theaters. It was only digital, but it's available everywhere digitally. So you really need to see that one. Okay, I have four more to go, and I'm gonna do the order. I don't know what order is best. I'm gonna talk about Swallow next. Swallow is amazing. It's one of the movies that came out relatively early into being quarantined and watching movies on my TV only and not having theaters. I would love to see it in a theater. This is again sort of like Spontaneous. This is a movie where it's sort of a genre you think you know, and then it introduces this like really macabre horror element into it and makes it something I think that much more special. So this kind of it looks aesthetically like a kind of Douglas Sirk melodrama from the 1950s. It's like gorgeous, soft focus, low contrast lighting. It's all very like glowy and pastel and like soft and delicate. And it's the story of this young woman played by Haley Bennett, who is, I guess it would be fair to call her like a housewife or a stay-at-home wife, and she is living this sort of idyllic-looking life, but inside of this life, she feels kind of like unable to control herself or her own life. And the way that she copes with that is she starts to swallow small trinkets and things and like thumbtacks and sharp objects and little marbles and process them and digest them, and then sort of like adds them to her little tally as trophies. And it's this sort of really like unnerving obsessive behavior that is also a really clear emotional manifestation of the situation that she is in. It also is a situation that has longer legs than we know, and I won't spoil how it, you know, evolves, but by the end of the movie, the sort of understanding of why she's doing what she's doing, I think, is much deeper than it is at the start, which is obviously an ideal situation that things expand rather than stay finite. But there's it's just an incredible movie. It's like it's such a problem that's like that's but also that is it's like an incredibly unusual problem, but yet also feels incredibly relatable and universal. This idea of like, I think many people have a behavior or, you know, particularly maybe a destructive behavior that is like weirdly a coping mechanism for feeling out of control. And hers is just swallowing things. John Waters put this movie on his top 10 list alongside Butt Boy, which I talked about in another episode. I did not put Butt Boy on my top 10 list. Butt Boy is also great. But yes, there is a sort of weird kinship between Swallow and Butt Boy. They're very different movies, but they're both are kind of like genre films that are rooted in this kind of like precarious and unexpected fixation over like the passage of items through bodily orifices. Anyway, so maybe a double feature between Swallow and Butt Boy would be a great time, I think. They're very different moods. That one's much funnier. This one is much more depressing, I think, and dramatic. But this is like, again, it's like visually perfect. It has such a specific look, and also the fact that it is that everything about the look and feel of the movie is of this genre that we feel like we understand, and we feel like we, and it's really good at that. But then there's this other thing, it's like, it's like, what if Grace Kelly ate thumbtacks, or like, like what, it's like this extra, it's this extra dimension that's a little bit warped and a little bit, macabre, but which really speak, it really speaks to the particular specificity of the character. Like, it's not like a random novelty or gimmick film. It's like very much about an extension of having control over the body. And I won't spoil all the particular manifestations of this, but it is, and also the scenes of like watching someone do something to themselves that is potentially harmful and having to kind of like, horror is, I think, best when the things that are happening have emotional significance. You'll probably sense that this is a theme throughout all of the films that I've chosen for this list. But in this case, in most cases, it's a sort of like externally afflicted, kind of issue. But in this instance, it's a sort of like an internally afflicted issue, but is still very emotionally driven, which I think makes it really special. And it is really a drama at its core, but it has this macabre element that makes it really kind of unusual and I think horror based. This next one I just really struggle to describe, so I just really have to encourage you to watch it. I found out just the other day it's going to be on Shudder in January. So when it comes to Shudder, if you're a horror nerd and you have Shudder, just watch it. I don't have a way of explaining it that's good enough. I mean, I probably don't for any of these, but this one in particular I struggle to explain, and that's The Wolf House. The Wolf House is an extraordinary movie from Chile, and it is a papier-mâché puppet stop-motion animation horror movie that is a nightmare imagining from the point of view of a cult leader dictator who is explaining to the members of the community why it is futile to run from him. Something like that. It is so distinctly what it is. It's unlike anything I've ever seen. It's one of the most incredible things I've ever seen. I've only watched it the one time. It's very difficult and very upsetting to watch. Choose a good day to watch. It's not violent or gruesome. It's just an incredibly surreal nightmare movie, and it kind of like it kind you know it kind of when people talk about things getting under the skin, I mean, it really kind of it brings you to this sort of space of real futility and it's a hopeless movie, and it's designed to be that way because it's meant to be the expression, like the sort of nightmare expression of this cult leader dictator figure who's sort of telling this fairy tale about why it doesn't benefit, why you shouldn't run away, and why if you run away, you'll just end up begging to return. And it really sort of works its way into, it's designed to sort of like bring you back always to the fold of this particular kind of cult mindset. So, it's not a fun movie, but artistically, it's brilliant. Like, all these movies are such incredible artistic achievements. It's all papier-mâché and like drawings on walls, and apparently it was done in like abandoned houses over the course of about 5 years, and it just was Like they would just go into these houses, the two filmmakers would go into these houses and like make these papier-mâché characters and draw on the walls and create these sort of like really nightmare images in these abandoned houses and compiled together. It's like it's so stunning to look at, and it's such a nightmare. It's like the it's truly it looks and feels the most like a nightmare of any movie I've ever seen. It's really exquisite. And I think there's also something there's something queer in the energy of transformation that all of the characters, the characters kind of are all imagined and made from like inanimate objects and come to being through paper, but then sort of like melt from paper into images on the walls and then transform into inanimate objects and again. And I think I don't know, there's something very queer to me about the sort of like the infiniteness of the identity outside of or an extension of the body, or the body being a sort of like permeable membrane of things as opposed to being like a finite container. That it just, I don't know, there's something, there is something sort of queer about it, but it's sort of like very intangibly queer. But I think it's also that's sort of an undercurrent about it as well that I like a lot. It just when it comes to Shudder, or you can rent it now, I believe, on digital. So just watch, just at some point when you want to watch something that's like exquisite and maybe challenging, whenever that day comes for you and you feel prepared to do that, just watch The Wolf House. You have to. It's so good. I can't. I need to. I need to sort of like profess this to the world. World, because I feel like no one's seen very. I don't know if anyone else has. I don't know anyone else who's seen it. So I want other people to see it and then talk about it with me. But watch The Wolf House. Okay, so I have these last two, and I saved them for last because I wanted to do spoilers with them. So let's say this: I'm gonna do mostly non-spoiler for this first one, and then I'm going to basically spoil the ending because I want to talk about it. So I'll tell you when I'm gonna do that. And then the last one, I just don't know how to talk about it without spoiling it. So I'm going to just do a whole spoiler on it. So the first one that I'm not going to spoil exactly yet, I'll tell you when I'm going to spoil the ending, is Relic, which was directed by Natalie Erica James, which I think is exquisite. This one is like, I rewatched it not too long ago, and I was reminded how perfect the screenplay is here, in particular the screenplay, because I did take 2 semesters of screenwriting. Oh, I say that like it matters, but I have at least read some. I read like a textbook on how to screenwrite, I promise. No, but I also have studied films for a lot, so more than 2 semesters. Anyway, but in screenwriting, there's usually 3 acts to a traditional Hollywood script, and the end of the first act is kind of the catalyst to action, and then the start of the second act is usually the beginning of the end, so to speak, in terms of the final conflict, and then there's a sort of come down or resolution or denouement at the end. And with this movie, you can like I could like tell you where I could tell you where the first act ends and where the second act ends, and it's very precise and very specific. And I don't want to spoil the whole movie, but something significant happens, and then we turn the page to the next part of the story, and then something else significant happens, and then we sort of begin the quest to the ending of the movie. And you can really just see, you could just like sense the particular pacing and structure of the movie. Just watching it, you're like, this is sort of, this is perfect. This is everything comes into place exactly as it needs to and when it needs to. I also am a huge proponent of I love a 90-minute movie. I know that that might be an unpopular or taboo opinion. I don't know. When I see a movie that's 2.5 hours, my eye in 3 hours, I become immediately cynical. My first reaction when I see 2.5 hours is like, oh, you think you're fierce, Miss Thing. You think you're worth 2.5 hours. Like, I'm such an asshole that when I see 2.5 hours, I just think, oh, you think you're 2.5 hours. You think you're worth 2.5 hours. That's really, so you think you're pretty. You agree that you're pretty. It's just, there's something about it that really like gets under my skin. I don't know why. I I'm less likely to watch something if it is more than 2 hours, and I don't. I'm not gonna justify it. I'm just gonna say that that's true. I've watched the movie. Watched the movie Zodiac like 50 times. So, if it's really good and I really like it, then I'm all for it. But I will admit, my initial reaction is, you think you're worth that 2.5 hours? You think you need 30 more minutes than every other movie? Lo and behold, I don't know. That's just the truth about me. And I love a 90-minute movie. Why? Well, go back to the screenwriting structure thing. There's three acts. Each act is 30 pages or 30 minutes on screen. It's perfect. It's symmetrical. It is. I like symmetry. One of the great kind of well, not Hollywood, actually British. One of the great kind of British pre-Hollywood Hitchcock movies is The 39 Steps. Which is like it's like a perfect script. It's three acts. Each act is 30 minutes. It's 90 minutes long. It begins in a theater. It ends in a theater. There's something incredibly symmetrical about it, and I think about that script a lot too. But I love a 90-minute, like three act, each act 30 minute. I love the structure of that. And I'll take an hour and 40. I'll take 2 hours, 2.5. You have to really earn, you have to earn it. Oh, you think, okay, you think you're worth 2.5 hours. Anyway, but so this is 90 minutes. It's like exactly 90 minutes. It's every act is about almost exactly 30 minutes. The first act, I think, ends on like minute 27, but the second act launches almost exactly an hour into the movie. It's perfect. It's perfect. It's perfect, perfect screenwriting. It is a movie about, I'll tell you what it's about. Oh my gosh. It's about a family. It's three women. It's an Australian movie. Three women. It's a mother and a daughter, and they go to visit the grandmother, who is missing, or they go to find her, I guess. And then they suspect that maybe she's not who she was. And of course, it's an incredibly vivid and I think much like all of these emotional version of a supernatural story where maybe there's a way in which it's a possession story. Maybe there's a way in which it's a supernatural story, but it's also very fundamentally about dementia and aging and losing the person that you love before they're really physically gone. And you kind of they're looking for, she's looking for her mother and her grandmother, and maybe the person they find isn't that person anymore. And in this case, maybe that has a supernatural bent, but it also has a very pragmatic, realistic bent. And now I'm going to spoil the ending. So if you'd like to click off, please do. But if you've seen the movie, here's I really want to talk about the ending because I love the ending and I have strong feelings about it. So the ending, if you've seen the movie, the ending of the movie involves basically. Oh, it's really good. Okay, so they sort of fight their way out of this house with this person who is, who it seems to not obviously not have the demeanor or disposition of their mother. And so there's a bit of a climactic fight scene, a sort of traditional fight scene where literally they rip through the fireplace, like the hearth of the living room of this house, and they like crawl through it. Like it's a sort of incredibly visceral, like bursting through the sort of like idyllic family room, right? And they finally have this confrontation and they seem to defeat the creature, quote unquote, the creature, and then they go to leave the house, right? Okay, great, good. But then Emily Mortimer's character literally turns around and goes back into the house. And then there's this incredible moment where she like peels away the exterior of her mother, and she's left with this sort of mysterious looking creature. And if we're supposed to take this as a form of her mother or something else entirely, I think is a bit ambiguous. But she basically decides to care for the person who is left. And it ends on this really emotional ending. And then her daughter joins her and it sort of ends with the three of them in bed, the three generations, and whatever form of their mother is left. And of course, the movie is, meant to be a story about dementia, about sort of making the choice to care for the figure that exists, even if that figure doesn't resemble the person that they once were anymore. But there's something even to me more in terms of horror movies, I think really poignant about that, which is, and I thought a lot about when I watched the ending to the movie, I thought a lot about Frankenstein, James Wells' Frankenstein movies, and the phrase "we belong dead," which is the thing that the Frankenstein monster says before he implodes the lab and buries himself with his bride. The idea of "we belong dead." James Whale. I'm sure I've said this, but James Whale was a queer filmmaker, and many people have read his Frankenstein movies as being an allegory for queer experience, as being about being persecuted for being different. And the idea of "we belong dead," like the sort of, if we think about the physical otherness of monsters in horror movies and the types of socially constructed otherness that we often graft onto that physical otherness in our interpretations of those stories, there's always this way in which the Frankenstein monster essentially killing himself and the bride is this way of kind of imploding a community that's defined by difference, right? There's a sort of like a self-destructive quality in saying we belong dead, like we the other things, the sort of physically othered and the socially constructed others, we belong dead. And what persists, in that movie are the quote-unquote normals, to paraphrase Vito Russo, who calls them in The Old Dark House, which is another James Whale horror movie from the 30s, but he calls the sort of he calls the other people the normal people. He means that they're the quote-unquote normal. He calls them the normals. So, but like the normals persist and the others perish, and that's sort of like been a general structure of a lot of classic horror. And in this movie, it's literally, I mean, every scary movie, the goal of the scary movie is to get out of the house, right? Like that's the goal. The goal is, well, you've got to get out of the house. And this movie is like, to me, it's a critique of the entire ending of the horror movie because they get out of the house, and then we're left with the idea of like, well, what would it mean to just leave this house behind? And what would it mean to actually leave the house, like to leave the situation and say this person belongs dead because they are other. And in this case, you can, extend onto the image of a physical difference, the idea of neurological difference, right? And so the movie is like this incredibly compassionate revision of the ending, I think, of the horror movie generally, which is in the horror movie, you want to escape the monster and get out of the house. And in this movie, they close the door and they go back in, and they kind of counsel and comfort the creature that's left there. And it's an ending of compassion toward the other, the figure of difference, rather than an attempt to escape or destroy that figure of difference. So I think, to me, one of the most beautiful things about Relic is it really feels like it is aware of the kind of structural ending where the movie presumably would go, and it achieves that ending, and then it says basically, well, this ending sucks, we're not doing that, we're going to do this other thing. And it's not in a million years where I expected the movie to end, and it was an incredibly emotional experience to watch. And I think it does incredibly diff like it's just I think it's an answer to literally every monster movie that's ever been made. And the answer is, but like what if you actually responded with compassion and care instead of responding with violence and death? And it's lovely. So please, I assume if you listen to that, you saw Relic. But if you haven't, go see it, rent it, whatever, digital it, make it happen into your television. The last one I want to talk about is the most recent thing I've seen, and I was really debating putting it on the list or putting something else on, or putting other things on the list. But I'm putting it on the list because I think it's like the one of the movies I would most, you know, of all of the movies I could think of to put on as on this list. This is one that I have a lot of thoughts about, and I feel like I am really interested about what the conversation will be about this as more people see it. And I think it's really strong, and I think anyway, picking 10 sucks. So it was hard, but this one is, I feel like I think it will, I hope it will age well. It's still very new in my mind. I hope it will age well, and I will think even more strongly of it as time goes on. And that's Promising Young Woman, directed by Emerald Fennell, which was released on Christmas Day, which is, you know, sort of one of the tail end movies to come out this year. It's a fairly high profile movie on relative to the other ones on this list. I think, short of Invisible Man, it's the only one that is a wide release studio film, which is totally coincidental. Probably because there were very few wide release studio films this year. It right now, I believe it's only in theaters, but it will be, I assume, on digital early in 2021, I guess, is my best understanding. I had a lot of expectations for Promising Young Woman. I really hoped that I feel like we've long been waiting for a feminist horror equivalent to Get Out, like a very contemporary modern take on feminism and horror that would feel like a cultural reset of sorts. And I had sort of hoped that this would be that movie. I don't know that it is, but I loved it. I think that it's been, Blumhouse in particular has done, in my personal opinion, a real like shit job of actually inviting women to be a part of the studio. Jason Blum had made those famously poor remarks suggesting that there were no women filmmakers who wanted to make horror movies, and then had to like eat all of his shoes, and then did a couple of what I would perceive as really like insufficient and uninspired remakes of properties that he had acquired, casting, you know, or sort of hiring women filmmakers and with predominantly, you know, women casts. And those were particularly Black Christmas and The Craft. Is it Legacy? I don't even remember. Which I don't think, I personally don't think either of those were very good films, unfortunately. I like Sofia Tikal, who directed Black Christmas, a lot. I like her film Always Shine. Is that what it's called? Always Shine, I think. And I like Zoe Lister-Jones, who directed The Craft Legacy. I like her film Band-Aid with Adam Pally. I think it's really great. I just don't think either of those films were very good. I don't know what the behind the scenes were. Black Christmas in particular seemed to exist very quickly. It felt like it was announced in the summer and then premiered in the fall. It was very fast. Anyway, I don't think doing fast reboots has really served women filmmakers in horror at the very high studio level, as much as Jason Blum seems to think that it has. I don't think those movies are good. I think one of the things about those movies that kind of sucks is I feel like they have both been criticized for having a fairly one-dimensional portrayal of misogyny, such that it seems to really evade the reality of misogyny, which is that it's sort of ambient and pervasive, and it's not the problem is not that there are exceptional individuals who are misogynist in the most egregious and vehement way. You know, not that's not only the problem. The problem is that there is a kind of ambient misogyny amongst people who are unaware that they are doing it. And I feel like those movies really put the misogyny on the shoulders of very like obnoxiously cartoonish, chauvinist men characters, in a way that makes that kind of like lets everyone else off the hook, so to speak. I think that that's something that we've seen a lot. It's something that we've seen in films, you know, in like early 60s movies, civil rights films, and particularly in the Hollywood system, you know, they would make films about egregious racism, about the most overt, egregious, simplistic forms of racism. And The implication was that those, the white, the quote unquote good white people could criticize the egregious racist white person, and then they were on the side of good. And the idea was to make white audiences feel good about themselves because they were not those egregious racists. When in actuality, the sort of problem was that there are very ambient and culturally structurally engaged aspects of racism that need to be addressed, which are not just the most overt and sinister versions of that problem. And I feel like we're kind of getting that with horror. I mean, not, which by the way, I mean this particularly with regard to those two Blumhouse movies, and I think some of the large studio horror films. I think there's brilliant feminist horror every year on smaller scales, but it is this kind of weird issue of like, why can't we take that up into a more visible place? Anyway, Promising Young Woman seemed to me to be like this great hope of maybe that could happen here because it's being obviously distributed in a wide release. It could have been a big hit. I don't know. No one even knows what a hit is anymore because no one goes to movies, and the theaters that are open are, I think, probably mostly empty. But anyway, when I saw this, I was one iota disappointed in the sense that I don't think it's like the best thing I've ever seen, which is a very false and unnecessary high hope to give toward any movie. However, I love it. I love it, and I think, first of all, I love the complexity of navigating the emotion and the sort of like pop candy sensibility of it, and also the really like cynical, sinister sense of humor. Navigating those things is a pleasure. And I think that there are, much like with Invisible Man, I think there are some sort of revisionary moments here. Particularly with the fact, so if you take the quote unquote, as described by Carol J. Clover, the quote unquote rape revenge film as a template for this, as this being an answer to an extension of that. There's some things that it does differently, which I think are really brilliant. One is that it does not fixate on the attack of a female protagonist. I think all of the classic films of that kind, which are very difficult to watch, which I don't really watch often, if ever, films like I Spit on Your Grave and Ms. 45, is one of the problems with them is, well, yes, there's a like there's a re there is a revenge component, but there's also, half the movie is just terrifying assault, and it just making audiences watch that terrifying assault in a way that feels exploitative and kind of gross. This movie is about the legacy of the trauma and impact of such an assault, but it doesn't focus or fixate or ever visualize that assault, which I think is an inspired revisionary choice. I also really appreciate, similar to Invisible Man, I think I started to say this and then I changed course, so sorry. Sorry if I made no sense. But similar to Invisible Man, the fact that the protagonist is never taken by the movie to be perceived as irrational or hysterical, right? Like it totally avows and sits us with her, her impassioned defense of herself and her impassioned defense of the legacy of her friend in this case. We're not. Does, we're not, it's not a movie that uses a trauma to turn a woman into a hysterical character that other people can dismiss. It's really about grounding the response to that trauma in reality, which I think is another brilliant revisionary choice. I also think, to go back to the idea of the most sinister version of misogyny, I think the undercurrent of like nice guy-ness is a rather brilliant choice here. I think casting all these like quote unquote nice guy character actors like Sam Richardson and Adam Brody, casting them particularly to sort of play off of that persona, I think is kind of inspired. But I think the most inspired aspect of the movie, and by the way, this is, I'm totally going to spoil the movie at this point. I kind of have, I don't know if I have already, but I'm just going to talk spoilers about this movie because I don't know how to talk about it without spoiling it. But I think the Bo Burnham character is like the most brilliant stroke in the movie because both the protagonist and the audience are sort of prepared to and do, I think, successfully grow attached to him. I think that there, the Paris Hilton moment is lovely. Stars Are Blind is a jam, and that whole Paris album is not bad at all. I mean, gay people know this, but if you're listening and you happen to not know this, gay people know that Paris Hilton album is actually really fun. Anyway, but there's these really charming moments, like rom-com moments. I mean, I would describe this movie most as like a macabre rom-com. Like that's what it is to me in the strictest sense, more than it is like a truly like a horror movie or or a revenge movie. I know that that's the plot structure, but to me it's more a rom-com that has macabre elements or horror elements. But because that through line at the center is so strong. And so anyway, the point that I was trying to make is because it really builds a world where the character, does grow attached to him and we grow attached to him, his very, and also the fact that his participation and implication in the assault is so vanilla and participatory and but like it's just it's in mostly inaction, right? It's watching. It's watching. It's not reporting. It's not reacting or responding or defending the woman who is the victim of the assault. That because he is just so kind of like terribly, incredibly banal in his like sinisterness, that it's just empty. It's just not. It's inaction. He's like it's a violence that's defined by inaction. That you really get to in what I think is maybe the best scene of the movie, where she confronts him about this and he's defensive and just bitterly, very pathetically, willing to turn anything against anyone else rather than look at what his involvement was. And also expects to be forgiven for it, and she just looks at him very, very calmly and says, "No, I won't." That's the best scene in the whole movie, isn't it? And I think that character and that particular aspect of the movie is the part that's the most brilliant, because it invites and makes clear that there is an entire society of inaction around the assault that allows the assault to go unpunished, and it's in the form of the Bo Burnham character and the Connie Britton character, the Alison Brie character, right? That all of these people are involved in letting this happen and letting it, and choosing always to protect the aggressor in the situation with the logic in some twisted way of protecting his promise, and that the promise of the women in this situation is not considered, and also it also you know they are their whole lives are laid to waste, and that society is essentially comes down to the point where everyone chooses him over her, and that is really at the root of the problem with the situation. And it gets at that in a really brilliant way. And I think that that's kind of what makes it a more effective and successful version of a mainstream feminist horror movie than some of these other ones that I've talked about, because it gets at the systemic structural issues. It gets at the non-vehement, non-violent participants in a way that some of these other movies just, they kind of just turn everyone into like creepy attackers, and then it becomes very easy to dismiss them and to see yourself as not connected to them in any way. And the whole point of a movie like this, I think, is to make sure that people understand that their passiveness and their removal of themselves from the situation, or their disinterest, or just passionate response to the situation, even though they perceive that as an inaction, is actually an aggressive action. And this movie actually taps into that, whereas some of those other movies I've talked about have not. Anyway, I think it's really brilliant. I love the references to Night of the Hunter as well. Night of the Hunter is one of my favorite movies. Charles Laughton, queer filmmaker. Watch The Night of the Hunter if you haven't as well. But I really recommend Promising Young Woman, and I really want to watch it again. So, I mean, I hope that I get to watch it in January at some point. But it's exciting, and I think it is, it's great. And I think it is something that I hope will. I hope I feel as strong in a year or more strongly in a year. I don't know. It's a very striking and kind of strange movie. So I feel like if I get to watch it more, I might have a better sense of it and a better feeling. I'm more kind of like totally. I might. I think it could grow on me in a way. Whereas right now I feel sort of like torn and confused about it. but I did love it, so I really wanted to put it on here. I mean, there's a million more movies I could have put on this list. There's so many great movies this year. So, if you made it all the way to the end of this, thank you so much for listening. I appreciate you so much. And if you'd like to send me contact me with your favorite horror movies of 2020 or any movies that you think I should know about, you can email me at gayforhorror@gmail.com. And thank you so much for being here. And there's one last thing I do have to tell you that it is contagious and we do recruit. So you're totally gay now. Bye.